From WUOT News, I'm Chrissy Kuiper, and this is Dialogue. On today's Dialogue, we're getting out of lockdown and taking the train with Todd Steed as we explore Todd's pre-COVID jazz music travelogue that has evolved into the podcast Improvisations to Go. We'll listen to an episode of the podcast, hear some of the jazz and the conversations that Todd found on his travels, and we'll have our own conversation, try to get some perspective on recent news in America, how it's all inevitably tied to the past, and possibly the history of jazz. So join us as we visit New Orleans, Memphis, and other places on today's Dialogue. First, headlines from NPR News. Welcome to Dialogue. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. My guest today is Todd Steed. Hello, Todd.
So awesome to see you. So awesome to see you.
I think it was March. I think it was the fun drive the last time we actually saw each other in person.
Yeah, this is Zoom is great, but there's nothing quite like at least six foot distance, but still in person, you know?
Yes.
I'd say six feet three.
We are socially distanced. Todd's got his mask. He's ready to roll.
Yeah.
We were going to do something a little different today on Dialogue. We are getting into a really hard time of the news. I mean, it's been kind of touch and go since March anyway, and the last couple of weeks have been extra stressful, and there's been a lot of really crazy news. So we thought that today we'd give you a little break and we'd try to get out of town a little bit and listen to some music and enjoy the memories of the pre-COVID era. And so we'll talk to Todd about his Improvisations to Go podcast. We're going to start with an episode of that podcast. This is the second episode. It's to help us get into a groove for the rest of the day. It's called Picnic Frame of Mind.
In mere seconds, you will be listening to Improvisations to Go. But first, I must inform you that this podcast could not exist without the support of Aubrey's Restaurant. They'll make it for you to go. Also, thanks to the generous support of Dr. Craig and Debbie Jarvis and their verified hunting poodle, Curly Sue. That's right, verified hunting poodle. So here I am, New Orleans, Louisiana, the Crescent City. Well after Katrina struck, but just mere weeks before the pandemic would hit with full force. Like in jazz music, timing is everything. I'm staying at an Airbnb in Bywater, sharing a room in a house owned by this really gifted photographer. There are fabulous photos everywhere you look. It takes me about 7 minutes to get anywhere in the house because I find it necessary to stop and admire artwork every step of the way. My small, comfortable room with shared facilities is about one-third the cost of a hotel and has 4 times more vibe. The only problem is there's really nowhere to get breakfast close by. So, I call my pal, Anthony Favre, a 5th-generation New Orleans native and proud UT graduate. When I ask him, what are you doing for a living these days? He says, he's a waiter with a microphone who goes to other people's meetings. Okay, I don't know what that means, but it sounds really cool. The last time I was here in 2002, I ran into Anthony by chance at a coffee shop. He's the only person I know in New Orleans, and I run into him in a coffee shop. Later that morning, he drops me off at the same coffee shop, and I run into someone else with a Knoxville connection. The point being, I guess, that Anthony's my chauffeur for the morning. He drives me to a place called the Ruby Slipper for breakfast. On the way, I completely ruin and destroy our old pal catch-up vibe by insisting on an interview. I do this a lot to people. And in Anthony's case, I didn't even give him the fun questions. For example, I asked him, Mr. Favre, describe your least favorite dental procedure. Mr. Favre, please discuss the worst 3 years of the 100 Years' War, but only do this in French. Or this one. Mr. Favre, What's the biggest challenge faced by the city of New Orleans?
The number one challenge in New Orleans is population. And related to population is economic development. Until there's some money in this town that actually gets down to the people in this town, it's hard for people to stay here. It's hard for everyone to make a living, including musicians. And, you know, this is what people have trouble understanding, right? That if you don't have a vibrant economy, it's kind of difficult. And so, and the population challenges of the city are basically, pardon me, population challenges of the city is that all the stuff that we need to do to fix all the stuff that we need to fix costs actual real money. And so if it costs actual real money, you need a lot more people sort of paying into the system so that the people who are here don't get hit with the full cost of those bills all by themselves. So population is the number one challenge, but population built on economic development is basically the story, and you can't really get musicians paid.
There are people I find it incredibly easy to talk to. He's one of them. We ended up getting into several discussions on breakfast option anxiety, mindless opposition to change, undervaluing and underpaying musicians, the incredible risk of basing your economy on local tourism. Mind you, all of this would play out when the pandemic struck New Orleans, except the breakfast anxiety. Anthony Favre, outstanding conversationalist, waiter with a microphone, and chauffeur, then takes me to the Bean Gallery so I can get my cup of tea and revisit the place where I ran into him by accident in 2002. While I was standing in line, I saw a guy that I was sure I had seen before. I'm pretty good with recognizing faces, terrible with names, but faces, yeah, I know I've seen this face. I asked him, do we know each other? He was sure we had never met, and I was sure that I had seen him. Turns out, we were both right. He was a drummer that I had seen play at the Knoxville Museum of Art a few years before. So what do I do once we reach this point in the conversation? I asked for an interview, and he gave me one.
My name's Aaron Curtis Hill, AaronCurtisHill, and I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana.
And what do you do here?
I'm a musician. I play drums in a band called Weather Warlocks.
What's like your scene like the indie rock scene or?
It's thriving right now, and it's I try to stay connected, but since we tour so much, I'm also kind of one foot in, one foot out. But I can say that right after Katrina, you know, for the first few years, it was slow developing, and you felt like you sort of knew every band in town. It was a real small scene, and now, you know, 10 plus years later, it's just exploded. There's every style and genre has just exploded, and there's just a lot of bands, and there's a lot of things happening. So that's really cool to see. Like, it's not as small as it once was, and there's just an explosion of music happening.
What do you think that happened?
I mean, I think that, I guess the biggest thing was the storm. I think people were sort of hesitant to come back the first few years, and I think as years passed, and we didn't have another major storm or anything like that, people got more and more comfortable with the idea of coming and planting roots here. And little by little, the city just kept growing, and then those, you know, communities grow and businesses develop, and art and music begins to thrive just as it does anywhere else.
When you talk to folks from New Orleans and you talk long enough, Hurricane Katrina is always likely to make an appearance. It's an event I'm still processing, so I can only imagine what it's like for the people that live through it. It's definitely a time marker, and it almost wiped out one of the richest musical scenes on the planet. But it did not wipe out New Orleans music. I vividly remember watching Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath unfold on television. It was like watching a slow-motion horror film, and I kept yelling at the television, but I couldn't stop it. I have to admit, out of that experience, I really lost a lot of optimism about how well equipped we are in this country to handle disaster, The loss I felt from Katrina was almost theoretical. For Dr. Michael White, his loss was real and direct. He poured that experience into what has become one of my favorite recordings, Blue Crescent. Turns out, that's his favorite recording that he's ever made.
That's my favorite CD. And the reason is, it's my first post-Katrina CD, and all of the songs on there except for one or two are original. And it was based on the emotions I had as a result of Hurricane Katrina. I had lost my home, everything I owned. I had a very valuable archive of materials. I mean, I lost things that were unimaginable. I had a lot of sheet music, thousands of CDs and recordings. I lost over 60 clarinets. Some of them were very valuable. Some of them had belonged to, noted jazz musicians. I lost things like I had this classic white clarinet mouthpiece that belonged to Sidney Bechet, which he's photographed with a lot. And then I had a trumpet mouthpiece from Jabbo Smith, Louis Armstrong's greatest rival in the 1920s. He wasn't from New Orleans, but I had met Jabbo Smith in his later years, several times. And I ended up with one of his mouthpieces, and I lost that. And, I had interviewed a lot of the older musicians I knew. I lost all of those things. So it was pretty devastating. But even worse than that, worse than all of those losses, the displacement and recovery process. I was in Houston, Texas, and that was so difficult, very stressful, very depressing, worrying about the condition of New Orleans, the future of New Orleans, people of New Orleans. I had known of so many people that died, either drowned in the storm, like some of the musicians that I knew and played with, people that died from heartbreak and depression, of having to leave the city, some of them for the first time, being older, not knowing what to do, and they just, died. Some people died from infections that they got in the toxic water, being rescued. Some people committed suicide that I knew. And so it was a very difficult time. The future was uncertain of the city, of the people, of the culture. And it was no easy end in sight in trying to come back and see what would happen. And so the whole idea of Blue Crescent, the title, was that the color blue means a lot of things. It can mean blue as in the blues. It can mean, imply sad and slow and mournful. Or it could be blue like a clear blue sky with clarity and beauty and hope and joy and looking toward the future, or like blue in the ocean. So, I think New Orleans was in the state of having all of those different meanings of blue as its condition. So I tried to capture that in the different songs. There's only one song that's really, to me, really sad and mournful, and that's the song Katrina, which I can't really play or listen to anymore because it recalls everything for me.
Dr. White's record is on Basin Street Records, a great record label headed by Mark Samuels. It boasts an incredible lineup that also includes Kermit Ruffins and Irvin Mayfield and dozens of other wonderful folks. After Katrina flooded his house, he ended up running the whole operation out of a coffee shop at one point.
So we have had to evacuate for hurricanes on a number of occasions, and this was one that, and I've usually fought my family on leaving because it is a lot of work to leave town. This was one that I did not need to be told twice. So we went to Memphis, and we evacuated there. And when the hurricane passed, everything was okay. And what eventually devastated New Orleans was the failure of three canal walls, which were poorly engineered and poorly maintained, and had absolutely nothing to do with a hurricane, other than they were full and the walls fell down. So New Orleans was treated differently as a result of the fact that it was not just a hurricane. going back for a second here, what gave me personally the ability to deal with it, and really in a, looking back now, I say relatively painless way, is that I had already endured a tragedy that was significantly worse than anything that I experienced as a result of the levees break. And that's that in 2000, my wife died and in a car accident, and I watched her pass away. And then I raised three children who were all injured as well for several years on my own. So I knew that there was, at that point that Katrina came along, I had met a new girlfriend, and I knew there was a light at the end of the tunnel, and I knew that, and so those things, those skills that I gathered as a result of the first tragedy, this one was really not the Katrina was not a really a big deal for me personally. But I hate saying that, knowing also that there were 1,800 people that died when the levees broke, including Irvin Mayfield's father, who was a drowning victim. And it was a terrible tragedy, and something that just I hope we all take lessons from, but we don't seem to.
I admit, it's hard not to share that opinion watching this pandemic unfold in slow motion, just like it was watching Hurricane Katrina. But here we are. And there I was in New Orleans, feeling just a little down, so I thought I'd go see Kermit Ruffins. I try not to lock people into some preconceived image I have of them before I meet them. I try, but not really very hard. I pretty much always lock people into some preconceived image. In the case of Kermit Ruffins, I imagine him to be laid back, genuine, friendly, warm, funny, and possessing a lot of heart. Nailed it. I showed up a few minutes early at his new bar, Kermit's Ninth Ward Juke Joint in the Holy Cross area. Before I got there, I went to St. Claude Fresh Market to grab a snack and, you know, maybe some dried pretzels or something. And I ended up having another unbelievable meal. This one just in the back of the grocery store. They were cooking up all this amazing food. I just pointed to it and said, come to me, and it did. It's like magic. I mean, come on, even the grocery stores have home-cooked food. Once I was full, I walked down the block, and there was Kermit, sitting in his bar, relaxed and ready to talk, as construction workers were putting some of the finishing touches on his new bar.
You know, I am blessed enough to be raised, right around the corner from here. Mom and dad, grandmother, grandfather, I mean, we would go fishing on Saturday mornings, maybe every other week, 4 a.m. We all up going fishing and crabbing. We back in the backyard by 11 a.m. Music cranked up, the barbecue grill going. We cleaning crabs, we cleaning fish, we freezing some, we cooking some. Everybody's drinking some good beers in the yard. I mean, we cleaning turtles and raccoon and just preparing for Christmas or Thanksgiving or whatever it may be, or just a normal freaking weekend on any given weekend. And I don't know how else how to live, but it's like I wake up with a frame of mind. It's a family reunion picnic every day. When I hit the stage, years ago, I always put in my head that I'm playing at my family reunion picnic. What would I do with my grandfather, my grandmother, and my mom sitting there? How would I show off for them? So that just, it just happens now without me even thinking about it. At one time, I just forced myself to think like that, just to say, hey man, this is a freaking picnic every day. So let's barbecue, so we can smell that barbecue. Let's put on some oldie but goodie music, Earth, Wind, and Fire, before the show. I tell every venue, put on Earth, Wind, and Fire, or Al Green, or the Commodores, I want that music before I go on stage. I tell every venue the same thing because it brings me back to my childhood, to the point where you're free when it's time to go to work, which is not work. You know, you're throwing a party every day of the week. I've been throwing a party every day of the week for about 40 years now, or more. I mean, a little less of it. And that's just the way I look at it, only because of my upbringing from my mom, dad, grandmother, and grandfathers, you know.
I bet they'd be proud.
Yes.
One thing that really strikes me about a Kermit Ruffin show is the band itself. They just have a great ease with each other. That probably comes from the fact they've been playing together for decades.
Yeah, we're the only band, I think, on earth that never had an argument. When we see each other, it's freaking party. We're rolling up reefers, we're drinking beers, flirting with the ladies, you know, just laughing at our friends that we've known since high school. I'm blessed to have a bunch of high school friends come to my bar every day. The same people I knew since I was 17, 18 years old. I'm still hanging with them almost every freaking day. So even my drummer went to high school with me. Kevin, he didn't go to high school with me, but he's been playing with me that long, too. And it's a bunch of laughter and jokes. It's just the silliest band on earth, guaranteed. With zero practice, zero rehearsal, I'll text them a song, and we just rehearse right on the people. It could be a full house. If it goes screwed up, we just stop the freaking band, everybody laugh, and we'll go to another song.
Kermit Ruffin, thanks.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, man.
I appreciate you.
We'll see you tonight.
Thank you.
I'll try to be in the right frame of mind.
Yeah. Picnic frame of mind.
Kermit Ruffin's, to me, is New Orleans, and I can't imagine going there without seeing him perform. Luckily, he's usually performing a couple of nights a week at least. I caught him at his other club, the Mother-in-Law Lounge. The incredible, colorful, vibrant artwork on the side of the building tells you exactly what you're in for. Mother-in-Law Lounge is a really friendly, intimate place. It's got a big pole in the middle of the stage. There isn't a stage, really. They're just standing there on the floor right in front of you. And then it's like Vaughn's, where anybody can come in, and everybody does. And everybody that's there is trying to do the same thing. Attain that special level of consciousness. Picnic frame of mind. The night I was there, I shared a table with a couple from Greece. They had just arrived by plane in New Orleans from Athens, Greece. This was their first event and their first trip to the United States, and I thought, wow, Kermit Ruffins is going to let you know what the United States is all about. And he did. It was just a wonderful show. He had guest artists. He interacted with everybody there. There were some jokes, which I can't repeat. Not because they're not suitable for this podcast, just because it wouldn't be funny if I said it. When I finally got back to the Airbnb, I was exhausted and reflecting upon all the things I had taken in that day, almost too many to mention. And it reminded me that there's two ways to travel, really. One is, you know, what I call the beach travel, where you go to the beach, you sit in a chair, you look at the water, and you go, ah, nothing wrong with that kind of trip. I miss that kind of trip right now. And then there's the other kind of trip where I go and I try to cram every single ounce of the city or place into my very being. And it's, you know, it's always impossible, but I love trying. Right before I drifted off to sleep, I kept thinking again about Katrina. It's just always sort of echoing in the back of my mind. And how do you bounce back from these catastrophes, these just unparalleled disasters? And I'm thinking about that right now. You know, we're going through one right now, almost in slow motion. And maybe our friends from New Orleans have an answer for us. Maybe all they've been through, they can help us out with some advice or a friendly tune. And I remembered my conversation with Dr. Michael White and how he talked about finding the way back.
Yeah, there is an arc in Blue Crescent, and it is a story about, you know, what we have, what we lost, what we want to see, and how we can recover. And, you know, one of the songs that people like a lot these days and I keep in the repertoire is the song Sunday Morning. Because what that song does, in one sense, I thought about the old Sunday morning church parade tradition that we used to have. And it was like the second line, but a little tamer. It was, you know, churches that would come together for pastors' anniversaries, religious holidays, the founding of a new church. And they would have a song, they would have a parade, and we would play up-tempo, jazzed-up versions of hymns on the Sunday morning. And it was such a beautiful thing, and there was such a sense of power and peace and people coming together to worship, you know, and looking for strength through the Creator. And so, you know, I wrote the song Sunday Morning as a joyous up-tempo hymn with that in mind. The idea of people in New Orleans coming together through strength and faith to rebuild the city and their lives.
These are crazy, weird, scary times right now, and I hope you're doing okay out there, because we got more traveling to do, okay? I'm Todd Steed. I'll see you at the train station.
One of the great ironies of jazz is that it's a music that was primarily created by Africans, African Americans, and they were the ones who were denied the liberties, the right to, you know, the great words that are in our Declaration of Independence and Constitution. They were denied those rights and privileges, and they came up with the music that best embodies what democracy is, right? The simple definition of democracy is everyone has a voice, and you work together for the overall, an oversimplification of what it is. But that's how jazz is. Everyone gets an opportunity to solo, if they would like, but it's all about what is the group accomplishing. So everyone has to work together, and that's why this band here really embodies that. It's not just everybody standing up, look, it's about me, and my. It's about what are we trying to achieve collectively. And that's the great gift, not only to the world, but especially to America, that the African people, the African descendants came together and said, we want to grant you this gift. And that's what it is. It's a gift.
Who was that, Todd?
Delphio Marcellus, one of several of siblings in the Marcellus family. And I think he was the perfect person to interview first. He was my first interview, and he set the tone for the whole series, you know. And it was also like an improvised interview. I didn't even have him. I didn't even know he was playing, because I didn't recognize the name of his band. And and so, you know, the Uptown Jazz Orchestra, I'm like, who's that? You know, and yeah. I'm like, oh, that's who that is. And I sent an email to his website, and someone responded like 10 minutes later and said, yeah, he can talk to you tonight.
Incredible.
And he gave me what I felt like was maybe the best interview of the lot. I mean, that interview went on for quite a while, and I posted the whole thing on iTunes under the Improvisations WUOT podcast page. But yeah, that's Delphio Marcellus, and he's just really incredible.
That sentiment, you talk a lot about that in the first episode of the democracy of jazz. And when you went to Vaughn's, talking about how there was a representative of every corner of humanity in this club, and that's the nature of jazz itself, is everybody working together, everybody playing together, everybody with a voice.
Yeah. And, you know, and it was, you know, it's really weird to even listen to it now, because when I went to New Orleans in December, okay, this is pre-COVID really, pre-killing of George Floyd, and it's pre all of that. I edited it during the early days of COVID and thinking, you know, like, God, the country has completely changed since I started this 2 months ago.
Yeah.
But now it's changed again since I edited it, you know, and it just goes to show you, you know, how fast things can change. And
how often they don't.
And how often they don't, right. And how important it is to listen to each other. And that's something that, you know, Delfeo really and I actually just mostly listened because, he was just, I think I asked a couple of questions that really sparked something he wanted to talk about. And it was this interesting foreshadowing of what's happened, in the last week.
So you said in the podcast, that just Katrina happening made you question our preparedness to dealing with tragedy and bad things. Has that changed at all? How do you think has that evolved for you since the, like I said at the beginning of the show, I haven't seen you in 2.5 months.
Yeah.
This is the first time we've seen each other in person. And, we've got a skeleton crew here at the station because of, social distancing and UT protocols. How do you think we're faring now? I mean, compared to, Katrina, which was, it seems like a long time ago, for a lot of people, it'll be just like it was yesterday, forever.
Yeah.
And
it, and watching that, when that happened, it was just like, it was horrific. And, one of the things that the podcast is, I feel like, is a love letter to the United States, a love letter to the culture and the art and the soul of these great cities, like New Orleans and Memphis and D.C. and Asheville, North Carolina is coming up. And so it's kind of a love letter to this country that I have unbelievable affection from a distance because I lived overseas, for a while. And mm-hmm. there was so much I missed about the country. But I got to just be straight up honest, I've lived in what are called developing nations, but, I feel like this country in a way starting to, look like through the lens of all that's going on, like a little bit, it has a lot of qualities of a developing, quote unquote, developing nation. And it's very scary. And, the musicians feel it. I think they feel this stuff very deeply. It comes out in their art. But yeah, when you can't have your doctors and nurses getting all the supplies and, how long it took us to get the testing. It reminded me, quite frankly, of a lot of the places where I lived, which, were called developing nations. But I feel like that term, I've always kind of disliked it because we're all developing individually and
right.
as a country all the
right.
time. And if you think you're there, if you think you've got it down, that's when you find out you don't. When you think you've solved the racial problems, when you think your infrastructure's just right, mm-hmm. when you start getting those feelings, that's a dangerous point.
Yeah, look out.
Yeah, because and that's right now it's very, very, all those things are just in so undeniable to witness.
Yeah, that episode is kind of like a little microcosm of the nation at large. Like your talk with Anthony Favreau about economic development and the huge tourism economy that New Orleans is dependent on. It's not unlike a lot of places in Tennessee, including, Sevier County and even Knox County to some extent. Mm. We have a lot of tourism dollars that go toward our civic budget. It's really interesting that people in New Orleans, and in one of the episodes you talk to Aurora Nealon and she says, kind of the philosophy and the psychology of New Orleans is in the moment, and that's part of what keeps people happy and part of what keeps them from probably losing it in the face of so much tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's the great dichotomy, of New Orleans is that it's really one of the funnest places in the world, like for me personally, if I go to New Orleans and have a bad time, it's my fault, typically speaking, even though I did get sick in the train station, as listeners to episode 3 will witness. But that was also
some good word jazz, actually.
Yeah.
your stomach ache word jazz, yeah.
Yeah, but the and Aurora Nealon talks about, and Anthony and other people, and Nick Spitzer, though I didn't use all of it, they talk about, that that in the moment thing, you got to be careful with it too, because if you're not planning for the future, or if your infrastructure is not good, or
right.
you know, you're not getting the help from the federal government or the local leaders, you know, in some cases, if you're not getting all these people to help, then you lose this place where the present moment can blossom like almost nowhere else and create a style of music that, quite frankly, has never been replicated anywhere else. You
no.
know, I mean, there's some big brass bands are starting to pop up, you know, in like New Jersey and places like that. But really, this music could not have come from anywhere else. And you know, it's worth preserving, and the city's culture is worth preserving.
Absolutely. And the technique itself is wonderful. I mean, that's the democratic movement of anybody standing on stage, whether you're in, you know, the Netherlands or Japan or, you know, a lot of other places where jazz is beloved, and there's an in-country representation of the form of music where everybody gets to play.
Yeah, and you know, when I talk about in this episode, I run into this couple from Greece, right? And it was really wonderful because I ran into him at a record store, and the guy was looking at a Kermit Ruffins record. And I asked him, I was like, "Are you a fan of Kermit?" You know, and he's like, "Yeah." I said, "He's playing like down the street, you know, walking distance." I said, "You should meet me there." And he said, "Okay." You know, it's just that kind of place, that spontaneous wonderfulness. And you know, he and his wife came down, and we sat together, and you know, the whole, you know, and there were a lot of people from the neighborhood and the bar. It's called the Mother-in-Law, which is just a great name for a bar. I mean, like, I don't know who came up with it, but score. And it was just like, there are people from all over the world there, and then there were people from the neighborhood there. So there were people in their 80s and 70s. There were young kids, you know, and the music, you know, and Kermit would bring these young musicians up. And this is something I think sort of comes across in a lot of the interviews, is how they really want to pass it on mm-hmm. to the next generation. And that it's a living, breathing of evolution of music. Each you know, Trombone Shorty and people like that bring their own thing to it. But almost every gig I went to, like the Uptown Jazz Orchestra, the drummer was like 21. And then you had Roger, I can't remember his last name, playing baritone sax, who played with Fats Domino. And wow. They're on the same stage, yeah. And that's like a transmission of something incredible. And, you know, in D.C. I saw that a little bit. In Memphis I saw that some. But in New Orleans it was like I saw it being passed on in real time from generation to generation to generation. It's incredible.
It's the real school.
It is. It is the real school. And you can go watch it for $20, you know, or in some cases free on the street.
Hey, Greg, let's take a break real quick and then play Into the Delta.
Cell phone coverage was gone, as was any sign of humanity outside the window. It was the Delta, man. It was beautiful and empty and full. I don't know how else to describe it. I noticed a lot of my fellow passengers were discovering the same thing. See a little bit of panic ensuing. Every single one of us had our faces just pointed directly at our digital devices since Memphis, not looking outside, not looking at each other, not looking at the Delta float by. But without that connection, we were forced to connect to each other. We went to the dining car, had real lengthy conversations. People that probably rarely talk to each other in real life were suddenly thoroughly enjoying each other's company. You know, when we're off the internet, no longer being forced into this pigeonhole or being placed in that demographic, when we're face to face, it's clear. Most of us really want to get along. I know we got a long way to go as a society. Maybe we'll never get there, but I do think we'll all be just a little better off talking on trains over tea and coffee than trying to get along on the internet.
As you said, Todd, a developing nation. So you were in New Orleans. The first six episodes are New Orleans, Yazoo City, and Memphis.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you were able to take the train and that you didn't have to be packed in a car and you didn't have to be on a plane. You could, as you said in the podcast, you could get up and walk around if you felt, you know, like you needed to walk around, and you could talk to people. Were people talkative?
Yeah, especially when they couldn't, you know, get online. That was when people really started to talk. So when I left, in actuality, I actually started in Memphis and took the train to New Orleans and took the train back to Memphis. When the internet went out and then the cell phone coverage went out, that was like, you know, the last drops of that for people. And they were trying to suff it up. But a woman from the Netherlands came up to me and goes, because I had some reading material, you know, a lot of it was prep for the podcast. And she's like, excuse me, sir, do you have anything to read? Anything at all? Do you have a book? And I'm like, yeah, I do, but it's really like specific about music. She's like, I'll take it. And then I started talking to her and then all these other people. And then, you know, the dining car separates first class from second class. And so you have to meet there. And that was the thing, you know, like, and I know, you know, Facebook and all these social media things, they have their plus sides. You know, I can find out if someone from high school I went to, you know, what school was in trouble and they, you know, or someone's getting married or, you know, maybe sometimes an interesting article or an interesting NPR article. But so much of it is just finger pointing and shaming and one-upmanship. And I'm guilty of all of those things, every single one of them. And I feel like people all have that in there, you know, somewhere, but they're less likely to feel the need for that when they're looking face to face with somebody, you know, just like someone is trying to take down like a baseball player on the internet, then they run into them, you know, walking down the street. Hello, sir. Yes, sir. And yes, sir. May I have your autograph, sir? You know, I feel like when, you know, all these different people were talking, to each other on the train, then their humanity came to the front of the conversation and less about their egos or their need to put somebody down or, you know, to align with some philosophy or whatever. And it was just fantastic. And for a brief moment there, you know, I was like, oh, man, this is the key. You know, how can we get out and talk to each other again? And that happened in a lot of the jazz interviews, especially in Memphis, you know, and even with Garrett McQueen that I talked to, who I, you know pretty well, you know, just – you know, just having these frank conversations that start out about music but go everywhere, it's really healthy.
To talk to people?
Yes.
To talk to each other?
Face
yes.
to face.
I feel the same.
And then you have the COVID thing, so then people are forced not to talk face to face. So that extra layer of worry for me. But
there's been an evolution there too, though, because, like, we've, you know, my family is small, and we're pretty good about keeping in touch with each other on the phone, but it's only, I mean, and we've all had FaceTime for ever almost, but this is really the first time we've used it, or Zoom, or, you know, the, just a myriad of programs and apps to be able to talk to someone to see their face at the same time that you're talking to them. It's like we were jaded before, and then somebody took our, you know, somebody unplugged it and we said, oh, no. I need faces. I need to be able to see people. Even the people who, you know, are complete introverts and homebodies and have really been training for this for some time, like myself, even I have been like, I really need to see a face right now.
Yeah. And that was what was so amazing about the whole project, is that I had no idea I was going to lose all that and that we were going to lose all that and these musicians were going to lose all that and like almost with the snap of a finger.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, it's funny because I talked to Greg Hill about, you know, maybe I'll do this in April so I can catch some baseball game. I mean, it's a pretty selfish secondary reason.
Priorities, man.
You know, I can't help it. And so it's like, maybe I'll do this in April. And so I can go see the Nationals, you know, play or whatever and make that part of the story. But in reality, I realized a lot of the interviews are coming together very quickly and people were like, I can do it in December. And everybody was at home in December.
Right.
In January. They're not touring. So I was like, no, I hate traveling in the winter. Of course, the weather was great. The music was everywhere. The interviews went really well. So I didn't realize I was getting this big dose of that great communal sharing and face-to-faceness, and then, boom, it was gone. I didn't know I was taking a picture of a family reunion that might not happen again.
Right. I know this is maybe impossible to answer, but I wonder if you could think about it for a second. You know, you were editing these and putting them together after COVID happened. So do you think your perspective changed? I mean, the way that you looked at these interviews that you did after, was it different? Did you ultimately end up with a different frame of mind than what you had set out to do?
Absolutely. And even, you know, that time I interviewed Ken Burns, I was telling him about this idea I had for the podcast, and he was going, okay, Todd, first of all, don't go down with an idea of what it's going to be. Mm. Go get the pictures, go get the music, go get the interviews, come home, sit on it for a month, and then start seeing what the story that's screaming to be told in there. And that's what I did. Like, I didn't have any interest in really talking about Katrina because I figured, like, oh, they're probably not going to want to talk about it. And, you know, I'll mention it, but it came up in every interview.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic came up, and I was like, that changed that whole episode, the picnic frame of mind.
Yeah.
Because then I was like, no, this relates to right now, you know, because we're going to have to recover from this. And so, yeah, absolutely, that new filter and lens and reality. And boy, did it make me appreciate all the things I was appreciating even more, you know, because I realized, wow, I may not get to see a show like this for a long time.
For a long time.
Or yeah. All my interviews have been Zoom.
Yeah.
I may not get to sit down with Delphi Marcellus or John Paul Keith in a bar.
Or Kermit Ruffins.
Or Kermit Ruffins, yeah.
Well, we just have a minute left. So what episodes are coming up? What's next?
Well, the good news is I overplanned, which is a bad and good tendency. So I have enough that I have a whole nother season left. So I got Washington, D.C., probably two of those, Baltimore, which I only spent 4 hours in because I was running out of time, but I just took the train to Baltimore. And that turned out to be great. Asheville, North Carolina, and then Kenton, Tennessee.
Where's Kenton?
That's what everybody wants to know. Even people in Kenton aren't sure. It's near Milan. Where's Milan? It's near Jackson.
Okay.
And so when I went to Memphis, I said, I'm going to pick a city at random and try to find jazz and make that the episode. Well, I failed. It was Jackson. There was none. There was zero. And so I found someone in Jackson and said, well, I'm going to be doing a parade in Kenton, Tennessee. Why don't you come up? It's about an hour north. So I went to a junior high Christmas parade where they played one jazz tune. So that's the episode.
Well, you did find jazz.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
That's really sweet.
Hopefully it turns out good. People will have to find out for themselves.
Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Asheville, and it's the last place I think of as like a jazz hub. But so I'm looking forward to that episode, too.
It turned out okay.
I want to thank Todd Steed very much for being my guest here on Dialogue today. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Thanks for Greg Hill for handling production and pushing buttons and doing things that are completely outside of what he normally does. Thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate it. Thank you all for listening very much. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News here at your NPR news station, 91.9 FM, WUOT. It is 1 minute before 1 o'clock.